magic lies within the trails we ride.
You're listening to the Journey On podcast with Warwick Schiller. Warwick is a horseman, trainer, international clinician, and author whose mission is to help people achieve a deeper connection with their horses through his transformational training program.
Just because he knows that you know.
G'day everyone and welcome back to the Journey On podcast. I'm your host Warwick Schiller and today I've got a special guest, but before I bring my guest on, I've got a little bit of tell you a little bit of a story about how this guest came to be on the podcast. And one of the earlier episodes of the podcast was called How to Manifest a Car Crash. And I talked about some of my experience with manifesting, animal communicators, and also coincidences. And lately I've had some coincidences happening that are pretty unbelievable. Back in, I think it was in December, on the 17th of December, I had someone on my Facebook group post and say, have you ever read a book by Richard Bach called Illusions, which I hadn't. And that was on the evening of the 17th. So that's the first, and I was 53 years old then, as I am now. And that was the first time I'd ever heard of the book Illusions by Richard Bach. So 2 days later, on the 19th, in the morning of the 19th, when the mail arrives, I get two hand-addressed packages in the mail, one of them from someone I know in England and one of them from someone I don't know here in the United States. And I open up the first one and it's a copy of the book Illusions by Richard Bach. And so, you know, about 36 hours before, I had never heard of this book called Illusions by Richard Bach. And then I open up a package from someone in England that was sent, you know, 5 or 6 days before. And it is the same book that I've only just become aware of, that they randomly felt the need to send to me. And I thought, wow, that is crazy. And I thought, I wonder what's in the other package. And so I open up the other package, and this is where it gets really weird. Same book. So, and I looked up how many millions of books have ever been written, and I forget how many it was. But if you take the fact I'd never heard of that book 2 days before, and then someone decides to send it to me, and they send it before I actually ever heard of the book, and you think about the odds of that happening are pretty astronomical. But then the odds of two different people sending me the same book, they arrive on the same day, 2 days after I first heard of that book, is completely mind-boggling. And then New Year's Day this year, so you know it's now 2021, New Year's Day, I had an 8 o'clock Zoom call with a gentleman from Texas who's a horse trainer and has a bit of an online program. And he wanted me to be on his, he was doing some sort of a course. He wanted me to be a guest speaker on his course. And there were some other people who were on the course. You know, I wasn't the only guest speaker. And so sometimes I'm a little bit wary about who I will appear with and things like that, in case the others are, how would you say it? You know, on a different path than I am. I don't want to be associated with someone who is on a completely different path than me. And I asked the guy, I said, so who are the other presenters? And he said, well, there's so-and-so who I'd never heard of. And then he said, and the other one is Susan Fay, who I'd never heard of. And he said, you should, she's written a book called Sacred Spaces. You should read it. It's a really good book. And something started binging around, the little sensor in my head started going, ding, ding, ding. And I'm thinking, where have I heard that? That sounds somewhat familiar. Not terribly familiar, but somewhat familiar. And I said, hang on. I was on the phone and I said, hang on. Someone the other day sent me a book in the mail and I opened it up and I haven't even opened the book yet. It's sitting on the kitchen counter. And hang on a second. It sounds a little bit like that. So I walk out to the kitchen. And there on the kitchen counter is Sacred Spaces by Susan Fay. And so if that wasn't crazy enough, then I started reading the book. And when I started reading the book, I was like, oh, I have to get this lady on the podcast. But in the book, it says a little bit about Susan Fay. It says, Dr. Susan Fay has been a professional musician, environmental scientist, rancher, horse trainer, sports performance consultant, hypnotherapist, and psychological health researcher. She bred and trained Morgan horses for over 20 years and accumulated world and national championships in Morgan dressage. She also showed her horse in open USDF dressage competitions, receiving several regional championships and a USEF, which is United States Equestrian Federation, Horse of the Year Award. She has a bachelor's and master's degree in environmental science and a PhD in psychology. So that is the most diverse range of qualifications I think I've ever heard. And so we're about to get her on the line here, but I'm really looking forward to talking to Dr. Susan Fay. Dr. Susan Fay, thank you for joining me.
Well, thank you for inviting me. This is just a thrilling time for me, and lots of things are happening now.
Oh, that's good. You know, you're one of my, I don't want to call you odd, but you're one of the odd guests that I have that I don't really know much about at all. I've had one other guest on here that I knew nothing about, and it was probably the most popular podcast I've done. So this one might be the same. When I did an intro for the show before, and I told the story about how I came to have your book and hear your name for the first time. We probably should finish that story off to where I posted on my Facebook group about what happened. Mm-hmm. And I explained the story about how, you know, the Illusions by Richard Buck showing up in the mail, and then talking to Noah here the other day on the 1st of January about this course that he was doing. And then he mentioned you were at, you're presenting, and then he said about your book. And then I said, hang on, there's something out here in the kitchen. Went out and, hey, the book has arrived in the mail yesterday. But then I posted about that in my Facebook group, and funnily enough, you replied to it. That was another oddity to the whole thing.
Yes, and the backstory to that was, on the 31st of December, I was sitting in my house and I was trying to think about what to do next year, this year, 2021. And I wanted it to be better than last year. And I had very little horse stuff going on just because of all that's going on in the world. And so everything was kind of slowing down. And I was kind of thinking, well, am I going to have to do a different kind of job just to make ends meet here and get going? And I was kind of frustrated. And I thought, you know, God, universe, whatever it is, can you give me some sort of sign if I'm supposed to continue on with the horse work? Because I'm feeling I'm frustrated and not getting ahead. And, you know, sometimes people are rolling their eyes at some of the things that I do because, you know, I'm a little bit different. And that night I went to bed thinking, okay, so I've got to make a new plan for, am I going to paint houses? What am I going to do for a living? And the next morning, a friend of mine had sent me a private message on Facebook and said, look at Warwick Schiller's website or Facebook page. And I thought, and she had a screenshot of what you had put on there about my book. And I thought, that is, if that's not a message, I don't know what is. That's a smack in the back of the head. If I don't listen to this message and respond, that's crazy. And for my book to find you on that very day that I had made that proclamation, like, please show me if this is what I'm supposed to do, I think, I just find it amazing. I find it absolutely amazing.
Yeah, I find stuff like that amazing too. One of the episodes of the podcast I did was called, it was on manifesting animal communicators and spooky coincidences. That was a whole 2-hour podcast of all the weird things that have happened to me, and that there is just another one. So in your reply to me on that Facebook group, you know, you told the story about how you had said, okay, I need a sign if I'm to continue this work. And you said, because, you know, people kind of roll their eyes at me and Tell me a bit about what it is that you do. We'll get into sacred spaces here in a minute and the whole book itself, but why do you think people roll their eyes at you?
Because I think what happens with what I do, and it's kind of evolved over my lifetime with horses and training horses and showing and all that, and it just evolved where I started thinking about doing things differently, that I watched the great riders, the people that were really successful, and I couldn't figure out what they were doing that was different, because some of them had great techniques, yes, but some of them didn't, and some of them didn't have great seats, and they didn't seem to have all the things you're supposed to have when you're a great rider and great successful person. And I kept looking and I thought, wait, it's something invisible that they're doing. What are they doing that's invisible that I can't see? And it kind of led me to a place of, okay, I'm going to look at sports psychology and that whole mental part of riding and training. And so I really got in depth in the science behind all the performance psychology and what to do and how to control your emotional state and how to control your mind and your thought processes so that you can slow your physiology down and be more successful. So I was looking at it from that way. So I would say my odd place is there weren't a lot of people doing that at the time I was researching it, and I couldn't find people to help me with that at the time. So I kind of went off on my own little journey in that direction. And as I started to implement these, just the basic sports psychology things about here's how to gain more focus, here's how to slow your mind down, here's how to control your thoughts, here's how to take rein over your emotional states and be very steady. And when I did all of that stuff, I started seeing massive changes in my horses. Massive changes in a good way. And so that then propelled me on other work with, okay, so what is it about my thoughts and emotions that's affecting these horses? How could they possibly be affecting this horse in the way that I see? And so that got me into a whole nother realm of, looking at the science behind what is happening in our brains, what's happening in our hearts, and what is it that's doing that? And it's all about the electrical activity that's going on when we switch between different emotions and we switch our thoughts or we have a lot of thoughts. So that is kind of where I'm at, where it went from that very real world sports psychology, performance psychology to something that was more invisible, that people maybe had a harder time thinking or understanding about, but it was all about energy. And when I got that piece of it, that it's about the energy that my body is producing, and the horse is reading that energy, and it's affecting their behavior. And when I could get to that point, I'm like, Eureka, this is it. How simple is that? And so basically what I do now is mostly just a lot of energy work with horses. I do less and less physical and more about checking in. Where am I at emotionally? What do I want this horse to do? Can I make a visual image of what I want this horse to do in my mind? And in that way, it changes my physiology and the horse reads that. And I just experiment with that with myself and clients, and they're having a lot of success with that, just the simple things.
So how long have you been doing, messing with this stuff?
Since I was about 15. It's funny, I really was studying a lot of this when I was younger, and you know how things progress over time, where you practice something, then you see results, and you practice, and then you go find more information on it. So it's been a process since I was 15 years old, and I'm 61 now. So I have done this a very long time as far as the energy work, but it has gotten deeper. And actually, when I wrote my book, it caused me to sit down and actually figure out what I was doing instead of just doing it willy-nilly and, you know, oh, that works, and I just do it naturally. I had to think about it. If I'm going to teach people this, I need to know what I'm doing.
So you almost came that in came to that kind of back, not necessarily backwards, but, you know, there's an old saying that says, you know, if you want to learn something really intimately, teach it. Because in the having to explain it to people, you almost have to explain it to yourself as well. And I've found that, you know, doing clinics, I'll be in the middle of a clinic and I'll be explaining something that I've explained 100 times before, but it will just come out a different way and I'll get like a deeper insight, like I will have an epiphany right there, like, oh, I didn't actually think about it that way before, but yes, you know. So I think explaining stuff to people or in your case, having to write it down in, you know, a non-tangible thing, write it down on paper to make a book, that's probably got to give you another level of insight to it you probably didn't have before.
And you're absolutely right, because before I did the book, I knew this stuff and I did it, but actually writing the book made me go deeper actually into the research and more explanations, more ways to, what I like to do too is take complex scientific theories and things like that and go, okay, how could we take that from that scientific journal or wherever we find that institution, that person came up with it, and use it in some practical way to make people's lives better. And that's where I think doing the book really helped me delve into that and go, okay, this is a complex idea, but how would I explain this really simply so that people could use it with their horse and see results right away? And that was my goal of writing the book, is I don't want a book that's so complicated people give up because, wow, that's science and my brain turns off and so I can't do that. And I want people to know, yes, you can. You can do it just as well as I can, or if not better. And that's the beauty of this, is I can teach it to somebody and they can be quickly come up and go, I just had success. This is awesome.
Yeah, well, I'm halfway through the book, and so far it's nothing out of the ordinary to understand. You know, it's very simple and understandable. I've got the book here in front of me, and for you listeners, it's called Sacred Spaces, but then the subtitle is Communion with the Horse Through Science and Spirit. So science, the quantifiable, and spirit, possibly the unquantifiable. And that's the thing. I had Dr. Stephen Peters on here recently. Do you know who Dr. Stephen Peters is?
Oh, yes.
Okay, yeah, well, it was interesting having him on because, you know, he was a neuroscientist. He's retired now. And whenever he presents or does anything, he has to have the science to back it up. But he's also got this, he's taken a deep dive into the whole spiritual side of it too. And he said, I'm so glad to be able to come on here and talk about this stuff, because I can't really talk about it when I, you know, when I present, because I have to be able to present actual factual, you know, defined stuff. And he says, this is great to get on here and talk about the woo-woo part of it. So let me ask you, I got some questions for you here, because I just read out your bio. So how does one end up being a professional musician, environmental scientist, rancher, horse trainer, sports performance consultant, hypnotherapist, and psychological health researcher in one lifetime?
You know, it's so funny because I look at that and I think, well, people are going to look at that and think, is she just really bored, or did she make all that up, or how did all that transpire? How did one come into the other? And here's kind of how that all worked out. So at 15 years old, my father was a musician, a professional musician and a teacher. And so being in that family, it was a requirement that you learn a musical instrument. So of course, you know, that was what I did. And when I was 15, he got me a job playing in a swing band. And I got that introduction to music and playing. And at that time, I was thinking about going into music as my thing, but something didn't pull me in that direction. And where I grew up, it was all about being outside and in the mountains and hiking and observing nature. And so when I went to school, I started in music, but then I went to go into environmental science, because to me, that was drawing me at the time into you know, my interests. And I thought, as a musician, what are my options as a woman in that time frame? And it's a hard life. And did I really want to do that? And did I want to teach kids how to play music, you know, how to learn an instrument? And believe me, with my father having kids come in and out of our house when we were younger, and they were at 7 o'clock in the morning on Saturday mornings, you could hear the out of tune trumpet player and you could not sleep. So, you know, I think he had this other plan, you know, get up and do things, you know. But I thought, no, I don't think I want to do teaching of music, and I want to do the environmental stuff. So I did that for many years, and I always had horses during all this stuff and riding and taking lessons. And as I got, when I got married, and my ex-husband had been a doctor and he was done with all his schooling, and I said, well, you know, because I went through all that schooling with you, I think you need to, we need to talk about where we're going to live. And so we both can be happy at a place that we choose. And he was also an outdoors type of person. And so we chose, oh, let's move to northwestern Colorado and have a ranch. And then you can do your environmental stuff there. And I can do my doctoring there. And it's perfect. And I found that a lot of what my environmental background gave me was how to do farming and ranching. And I also saw through that environmental thing how everything is connected. We're always dealing with systems and relationships between those systems, and horses and all that is just another part of that whole idea. And so, you know, I kind of just transitioned to that, just found it very easy to look at horsemanship in the same way I did at the environmental stuff, that if something's wrong somewhere in the system, the ecosystem, you go and find out what happened, and you go explore and find out where something went wrong.
So, yes, it's all connected. That's the message that keeps coming back no matter what I do. It's all connected. You know, you mentioned something early on there that I have found is a very common theme. And I've been reading quite a few books on shamanism, you know, and traditional healers and stuff like that. And there's something that they all do as part of their learning is spend time sitting still in nature, observing. And I think there's just something about that does something to a human that you cannot get that any other way. Being in nature and being still and being present, I think that does something to a person that, yeah, like I said, there's no replacement for it.
And I absolutely agree with that. And I think that's why I'm here where I am doing what I do now, because I had 20 years of being on a ranch in the middle of nowhere, not seeing people for maybe 2 weeks at a time, other than my husband in and out. And I had to sit with animals. I observed what they did out there. The cattle, the horses, llamas, donkeys, whatever it was, wild animals. And I sat, like you say, in that silent place, because in the silence is where our brain integrates information and comes up with more ideas. And that's where I think I find it really sad for people that don't have the opportunity to do that and sit in silence and see what comes to you. And as humans, we're so busy all the time, and we're always, it's almost like the people that I run into feel very uncomfortable if they're sitting in a place of silence. And that's just the opposite of me. I'm comfortable in that place of silence doing nothing, because I'm really not doing nothing.
Right. You know, you said before, when you sit in silence in a place like that, it gives your it gives your brain time to, I think you said something about come up with things, but do you think the brain's actually coming up with things, or do you think it's tapping into some sort of collective consciousness?
I totally believe it's our access to the collective consciousness. Yeah. I don't believe that I came up with any ideas I have. Yep. Other than the fact that I could sit in silence and I know how to connect, actually now in a very intentional way, to that, I call it the internet of intuition. And that's where I work from. When I'm with a horse, there's a lot of times where I go, I have no idea what to do. Something presented, or I'm working with some clients, and I just sit in this place of silence with the intention of connecting to that, and an idea will pop in. I'm sure you've had that same experience.
You know, I'm really late to the party, and that's why I'm so excited to talk to you, because I don't even know how much you know about me. So, you know, if you're like, you're on my Facebook group, so you obviously you're aware of who I am, but I don't know how much of my past you know of, but I'm kind of late to the party, and it's only been in the last 4 or 5 years, you know, about 5 years ago, my wife bought a horse that I thought I could solve the issues that he had, and he really showed me that, hey, you have no idea what you're doing, because nothing I did previously worked. And it wasn't like he had behavioral issues, like he was doing anything silly, but he was just very, very shut down in his own head. And he really made me take a step back and look for other ways, other things like that. And then because of that, looking for other ways and different things, that led me to have, I don't know if you're much of a fan of Brené Brown, but it led me to have, you know, Brené Brown talks about, I had a breakdown, and my therapist calls it a spiritual awakening. I call it a breakdown. I had whatever that thing is. I had one of those, and kind of turned my world on its head, sort of thing. And that was about 3 years ago. So it's only been about 3 years that I've been, you know, probably connected to everything and listening. And you know, I was very, very, very much in my head all my life, not in my body at all. I had a case of being shut down for most of my life, and so I'm new to the party. But the thing in my with what I do, you know, traveling around the world doing clinics every weekend, I get to work with 12 different horses and try different stuff. And once I started working with what it's from this book of yours, what seems to be you've been doing for a long, long, long time. You know, it started rolling from there. But reading your book, it's like, oh, 30 years ago, you came up with the same stuff I've come up with in the last 3 years. And it's not like I read it in your book and decided to implement it. It's just stuff that's come to me. And so I don't think I've ever been terribly intuitive, but I've never had any information coming in. You know what I mean? I've never had that somatic. Mm-hmm. I've never been in my own body to experience intuition. I've been stuck in my head, sort of thing. So yeah, I think I'm getting it's coming more and more, but it's, you know, it's an undoing, quite a process of undoing stuff.
You're exactly right, because there is, you know, I guess in my lifetime it was always such a natural part of who I was that I didn't think it being odd or abnormal. And so I just always went with it. I'm always at this place where, okay, I have this intellectual, clearly I love the science and that intellectual part, but then I'm always using intuition to guide the science and then the science to guide the intuition. I know how science can help us find our intuition. And so we can't shut down either one. And we're just in that journey of, you know, helping right now. I'm trying to help people find out, where do you find your intuition? And how can you start to develop it more, make it stronger, believe in it? And that's what I love to see is people go, oh, well, I was in here and I did this and I felt this. And I go, yeah, that's exactly right. That's exactly what I felt at the same exact time. And so it gives them that sense of, wow, I have intuition. I just don't know what it looks like for me. I just never paid attention to what it really is. Because it's always there.
Yeah, I think for me, I'd never really paid attention to it, but I think I may have shut it down very, very early on in life too. And I was talking to I'll have to get her on the podcast, but there's a lovely lady from California named Kerry Lake. Have you ever heard of Kerry Lake?
Yes.
Yeah. So Kerry is you know, to put it in a roundabout way, she's an animal communicator, but she teaches people how to do it. And she says, I'm not teaching you anything. I'm just helping you remember. We all have this ability, and, you know, it just gets tamped down over time by society and, you know, our culture and all that sort of stuff. So, yeah, I think that's really what's going on. So, you know, I said that the subtitle of your book is Compassion with the Horse Through Science and Spirit. And you've got, you know, I spent a year doing a type of therapy called dialectical behavior therapy in 2018 it was. And they had this, one of the first things they started talking about, it was like this little Venn diagram thing, and it had, it was basically right brain, left brain, but it was, you know, it was, one side was the emotional, one side was the thinking side, and then the place where they cross in the middle, I forget what they called it, right mind or something or other, but you seem to be very, very, very much in the middle of that thing, whereas, you know, some of the people, because I did individual and group therapy, but some of the people in the group therapy were very emotional and stuck in that emotional side, and I was completely stuck in the other side, and they were trying to get us to go to the middle, and you seem to have a, you know, it's instead of it being like a Venn diagram where these two circles cross slightly, it's almost like these two circles are on top of one another, where everything is the intuition and the highly analytical all in the one place at the same time.
Exactly. And I don't know. I think I credit my father and mother. They were both teachers, and they encouraged this part of us where, for all the kids, where we did, of course, the music, which is very much about the emotional feeling part, but also has a component of that left brain. You have to be able to read music. You have to know all that. And then they would encourage art, things that we would do, you know, just fun little art projects or things that we would do. And I then at the same time, we were expected to be very intellectual and do well in school and to study and to excel in those areas. So I think I can credit my father and mother for creating that, what we call the double dominant, is when you use left and right brain equally, essentially. And for me now, I feel like, oh, there's times where I engage more of my right brain because I'm going to be working with a horse and I need to be in that more feeling part of my brain instead of the intellectual part. And then I will go do some kind of statistical analysis that will require extreme diversion to that left brain place and doing all those equations and thinking of that stuff. It's more on the left brain, left hemisphere. But at the same time, I'm doing both both at the same time. And I just think this is a perfect place to insert this little story that I have about, I was in school and I'm doing research, and evaluation is the emphasis area that I have in my psychology degree. And so I was doing a lot of statistics and all this. And I was in the one of the final statistical classes, and it was just really hard. And people were just freaking out, and they're psychologists, so they tend to be more in the right brain. And so if they shut down whenever they get anything that has to do with numbers, so they would be freaking out. And I'm like, I got this. But I finally came to a place where we got this assignment, and the teacher said, okay, here it is, and turn it in next week. And I worked on it for 3 or 4 days, and I was at a loss. I could not figure it out at all. And so I thought, okay, why? Why can't I figure this out? Let me go ahead and do this process that I do where I'm going to go to sleep and I'm going to give a directive to my subconscious mind as I go to sleep and tell it to go to work on that problem. And maybe in the morning, it should give me the answer. I'll know what the answer is. And I thought, this is my last resort. This is my last chance. So again, here I am. I'm going in, shutting off that intellectual side, I'm going into my subconscious in the dream state, and it's just had a directive, figure out the answer to this problem. I should have specified I wanted at 7 or 8 in the morning. No, it came at 2 o'clock in the morning. All of a sudden, in a dream or somehow, it flashed the entire equation and how it fit together and what it did. And I got up and I went and did it on the computer, and voila, it worked. you've got to be kidding me. And it's that ability to access that other realm where all the answers exist. We just need to know where to ask or who to ask. And it's often not the source we would have gone to. So
you've got to be specific about what time you want it to come to you. And that's not 2 o'clock in the morning.
Right. So, that was one of the lessons I learned. It's much more helpful if it comes at a normal waking hour. But, I wasn't going to argue with that. And the funny thing was that I got the answer right. And one other guy that went to MIT got the answer right. And the 50 some other people in the class did not. And the two of us got so many extra credit points, because I guess this was such a difficult thing that we didn't even have to go do the final or do any more work for like the second half of the semester. But what I want to emphasize by telling this story is that it wasn't that I knew that answer within myself. I had to go outside of myself to a different place to find that answer. And what I think is, as we're working with horses, we have this, all these things that we know and techniques we know, and then we'll hit that block, like you were saying, you hit that place where you didn't know, and that's when you access this other realm.
Wow, I guess you got to be looking for it. That's got to be, for me these days, no, that's not hard to believe, but I think for some people that's still got to be quite difficult to wrap their head around.
Oh, it absolutely is. And I think what our problem in our society has been is that we have never taught people how to use their own brain. We teach kids that you learn information, you memorize it, and then you do something, you write it down on a test, and that tells everybody you know how to do that. They don't teach you about anything about your emotions, how your thoughts work, how you might access different parts of your brain, right and left, and when they might be important for doing a certain task. And I think a lot of times kids fall through the cracks if they're not good at the memorization and the regurgitation of facts. Mm-hmm. And they actually think and operate in a different way, and we're not helping them. And I believe, it's funny, I think I was watching something with William Shatner, and he was doing this series, and he was talking about, we know so much about the oceans, and we know so much about space, and we know so little about how the human brain actually works. And I think that's true.
He's a pretty interesting dude.
Yeah.
He shows reining horses, so we used to see him at the reining shows quite a bit, and pretty cool fella.
Yeah, I think, and like you're saying, it's hard for people to wrap their mind around a lot of what I do because it's brand new. Well, it's not brand new, let's put it that way. It's not brand new, it's just a brand new concept to a lot of people because it's not been emphasized. And I think about it, there's this guy back in, I think, like the early 60s, and he came up with this theory called the diffusion of innovation. And what he talked about was how different new ideas become adopted and how they first are adopted by just a few people. And then there's this other group of people that sit back and watch and see what happens to that first group of people. They're called the early adopters. And see what happens with them as they navigate through this new idea or new concept. And so there's not a very high percentage of people that are those first adopters to a new idea. It's only about 12.5% of the population, 13% or something to that effect. So it's a very small group of people, and they work for a long time, and they do different things with this new idea and test it out and experiment with it and see if it works. And those other people sit back and say, I'm just going to see how that works out for them, because I'm not sure I want to jump off where I'm at now and just adopt that. And then as time goes on, then these, I think they call them the early majority. And they come on and then they start doing it because they've seen other people have success. And then there's a late majority. They come after they've watched these other people and they don't want to lose out on the new idea. And so they jump on board. And then there's always that group of people that no matter what, they can't accept a new idea. And so they just stay where they're always at. But it's tough being on that place of coming up with new ideas because you get the scrutiny, you get the eye rolls. Like I said, I've been so many times, oh, that can't possibly work. And so coming across that 13.5% of people who are early adopters, that's not a lot of people out there who are willing and brave to jump on.
You know, I think, at least in my case, I was lucky enough the way the whole thing went down to where I think I had some credibility with, you know, quite a large number of people before I started down on this rabbit hole. Mm-hmm. And it's been like reading your book, I'm like, Yeah, I figured that out. But I didn't figure it all out at one time. So it wasn't like I all of a sudden was spitting out everything you're talking about in this book. I kind of had mm-hmm. one bit of an idea. So it was basically what I used to do, but slightly different. And then I kind of incorporated that slightly different into what I do. And I think people were, I'm good with that. And then it got a little further and a little further and a little further. So I kind of titrated this whole wackadoodle stuff to a lot of people to where it wasn't this huge, big, crazy thing. So yeah, I haven't got as much eye rolling as you would have had to put up with over the years.
And that's okay. Cause I think it's all, I really appreciate people like you who are brave enough to go, I'm going to talk about this thing and bring it up so that it becomes part of the conversation and that we can begin to think about these things in a different way, like you said. And I don't believe anything in my book is not what a lot of horse people have already done. I'm just reminding them that they do it, and I'm encouraging them, I'm giving them permission to do it, and I'm giving them the science behind why what they're doing is working.
Yeah, I think a lot of people maybe do it without even being aware they're doing it, especially talented people. Mm-hmm. I had Patrick King on my podcast here a little while ago, and he was actually out here visiting recently, and he does a lot of in classical dressage in hand work, and he was showing mm-hmm. me, he brought one of his caparisons with him and he was showing me what he does with it, and he had it on my wife's horse, Ray, and he was out in the arena. And so he's just standing beside the horse, and he's got his hand on the nose piece of this caparison. And he started working on some stuff standing still, but then he started working on some stuff while walking around, basically backwards. So he's in front of the horse facing the horse, and he's got the caparison in his left hand, and he's kind of walking around backwards in an arc. And I forget what it was I asked him, and he said, oh, yeah, I've got a sucking energy in my abdomen while I'm doing this. But I'd been watching him for half an hour, and he hadn't mentioned, you know, he was telling me exactly what he was doing, but he wasn't telling me what he was doing energetically. And he goes, oh, yeah, of course you're doing that.
Yes. And that's why I love studying those people that, at the beginning of this, when I was saying I was studying those people, like, I don't know how they were doing that. And I need to find out, what are they doing that makes them different? And it's that invisible thing that nobody really talks about, because for the people that have always done it, it's so natural. They don't even think like, well, of course, you know, I shouldn't even have to mention that, right? For Patrick.
Yeah. And, you know, for me, I no longer train horses for other people. You know, I trained horses for the public for 25 years. And I actually think not knowing this stuff was very helpful for that. Mm-hmm. because I could train a horse for somebody and hand it to them, and it would work the same for them as it did for me, because this rein meant this and this rein meant that and this leg meant this and this leg meant that. But there wasn't that energetic exchange part of it. And I think me kind of being shut down and having no like internal energy, like that was just completely dead, I kind of taught horses to not read that part.
Mm-hmm.
So then someone can come along and have a bit of inner turmoil or whatever, and it doesn't really affect them, because I it wasn't like I had a lot of inner turmoil and I taught the horse to not respond to that.
Mm-hmm.
I just had no inner energy. So that didn't factor into it. And so I think it may have been almost helpful to be a trainer for the public, to be able to churn out horses that work for anybody, sort of thing. But these days I don't think I could actually do that, because there's just so much to what you're thinking and how you're thinking and what you're feeling and what you're doing with your energy that comes into it, that I really don't think I could train horses for the public anymore.
And I got to that realization early on, and I'm glad you mentioned that, because what I want people to understand about when you begin to train a horse using this energy with very clear intention, I'm thinking this, you do that, the horse gets used to that. The horse expects that you're going to speak to him in that way through the energy. And then they get the person that's not. Let's say you sell that horse and it goes to a new home, and that person has all those conflicts, emotional and mental conflicts, and then the horse is going, wait, I have no idea what to do with this. No idea at all. And so I felt like I did a disservice to my horses by training them through this energy and then sending them out to a place, and then the person calling me up going, well, this horse isn't trained to do this. It just freaked out on this, or it did that. And I could not for the life of me figure out what was going on until just recently, when I really understood more about the energy part of this. And so you're right. I would like to think, when people come to me, that what they're wanting is they've got their own horse and they're saying, I want a better connection. That's the universal answer to what would you want from your horse. For all of the clients that come to me, I want a deeper connection. And so then it's that invitation to go, okay, so here's what we can do that. But you're right. If you want a horse anybody could ride, that's safe out there, that can tolerate a lot of turmoil, then probably look and do something different. Although I do have horses that I can put people on that have a lot of turmoil, and they're steady enough in themselves and confident enough that they can, they'll do the, I look at me like I, and I just kind of go, yeah, you got this. And they'll take care of them, because they were trained through kindness, through compassion and empathy.
Right.
And these horses don't have a mean bone.
Yeah, I don't think any horse has a mean bone, really.
No.
You know, it's funny how your perspectives about all sorts of things change over the years. And you know, these days, I don't really look at things as that horses do as problems, but just as very clear communication on their part, on the horse's mm-hmm. part.
Yes. And I think people, what I run into is like, well, can you fix this problem for my horse? And really what they're asking is, can you fix this behavior? And yeah, you could fix the behavior, but another behavior is going to come in to replace it, unless you find out what the root cause. Where did the communication break down between you and the horse? And where did that horse feel like it didn't understand something, and it need to keep escalating behaviors until you had no choice but to pay attention? Because the behavior came, it was not a surprise. A lot of times I'm like, well, that's not a surprise that behavior showed up.
Yeah, and I really
people want you to, yeah, fix the symptom, the behavior, the symptom. But no, we got to go to the root cause. What caused that behavior? Because every horse you ever own will have that same behavior if you don't figure out what you're doing.
Right. And I all the way along, even before, 4 years ago, I was always working on fixing the cause, not the symptom. But I actually think these days that a lot of times the actual symptom is the person's perception of what's going on.
Mm-hmm.
The problem really is the person's perception of what's going on. And yesterday I was outside building a fence and I was listening. I listen to a lot of audiobooks and I was re-listening for, I don't know how many, the umpteenth time to Eckhart Tolle's A New Earth. And
yes.
There was a quote in there because I had on my Facebook group in the last couple of days, I've had several people on there saying, my horse does this. How do I fix that? And it's for me, it was more their perception of the energy they had in there and their judgment and stuff of what was going on rather than what was going on that was the problem. And so I posted this quote on my Facebook group last night. So just imagine this being in Eckhart Tolle's Teutonic voice, says, when obstacles or difficulties arise in the work, when things don't go to their expectation, when other people or circumstances are not helpful or cooperative, instead of immediately becoming one with the new situation and responding to the requirements of the present moment, they react against the situation and so separate themselves from it. There's a me that feels personally offended or resentful, and a huge amount of energy is burnt up in useless protest or anger, energy that could be used for solving the problem if it were not being misused by the ego. What's more, this anti-energy creates new obstacles and opposition. And then I said, or as Captain Jack Sparrow puts it, the problem isn't the problem. Your attitude about the problem is the problem.
Exactly. Isn't that beautiful? And it's so appropriate.
Yeah, one of the big lessons I learned from my year of dialectical behavior therapy was about judgment. And, one of the exercises we had to do for that was this week, your exercise for homework is to count your judgmental thoughts. And when they said that, I thought, oh, well, this would be easy. I'll have about three each day, And they said, get one of those little clickers like the bouncers have when people go in and out of nightclubs or like train conductors have, just a little clicker thing. Or they said, put some rocks in one pocket and, when you have a judgmental thought, move the rock over to the other side. And I thought, yeah, well, I'll be able to put three rocks in my pocket and during the day I'll gradually transfer from one side to the other when I have these three judgmental thoughts I'm going to have during the day. And the first day I started on that, I had 21 before breakfast.
Oh, no.
And I just realized how many judgmental thoughts I have about everything. And then I really noticed it with the horses that instead of being able to see what they're doing for what it is, you have it, you judge it and have a story attached to it. And then that changes your inner energy, which creates, like the last line of this thing of Eckhart Tolle's, what's more, this anti-energy creates new obstacles and opposition. And it's, having that judgment about things and, labeling it and, quantifying and all that sort of stuff, it changes your energy and actually makes the problem worse.
Absolutely. And I think it's beautiful that how stories can really change relationships with people's horses. And instead of telling the story about everything that's wrong, like you said, there's that energy associated with the judgments. This is wrong with my horse. That's wrong with my horse. Instead, I have them switch that and it's like, let's not talk about any of that. Let's make a new story. You're going to run the new story for your horse. What do you say is the greatest thing your horse does? And you build him up with the energy, because when you talk in a positive way, you're going to create positive emotions and you're going to have positive thoughts and the horse is going to feel those and it's going to feel better about itself. Because when you come in, what does a horse want to do? He wants to feel good about himself. If he feels good about himself when he's around you, he's going to want to be around you. And it's as simple as that. And so change the story. It's beautiful. And I love the way you're looking at it. And we all are thinking these same things, but maybe saying it in a little different way. But hopefully, as many times as people hear these things said in different ways, and they start to look at it, and they'll start to incorporate that into their own way to do it, and their own way to think about it. And I'm just commending you for taking these steps, because I don't see a lot of the other horsemen on the, you know, that have as wide an audience as you and Noah talking about these things, other than maybe the Ritters in Spain, I think, and, you know, a few little pockets of people around.
Well, that's the funny thing, is this stuff is not, it's not out there. And, you know, I had to, it's funny, I had a thing happen at a clinic here at my house in 2017, I think. And it was during a clinic, and there was this, a thing happened where I started looking at things quite a bit differently. And I've got a friend of mine, her name's Katie Negranti, and she trains horses too. And she was here at the clinic, and she was staying in her trailer outside. So the clinic was over. It was Sunday night. I'm actually in bed, and I'm on the laptop, on my laptop, looking up something or other. And I came across this article, and I forget who it was by, but this article was like, that's it right there. That, and I sent it to Katie, who was outside in her trailer, and she's like, and she read the article. She's like, yeah, that's it right there. That's what we figured out this weekend in this clinic. And it's, but it's, this stuff is not, it's not mainstream, you know, which is why I had to, like, I didn't learn it. I had to figure it out for myself, because, you know, if it had been out there being taught, I'd have been doing it. Because it's, I think once you see this stuff, you can't unsee it, but it's just it's not mainstream. It's just like you said at school, kids are not taught, they're not taught about emotions, you're not taught about your energy, you're not taught about really how, you know, how we work. You know, we're taught a lot of stuff that it has nothing to do with that. And, yeah, it's just not mainstream. But, you know, if it had been, someone else would have taught me how to do it instead of me trying to figure it out. I'm just looking at your book right here. Just look, I haven't been very much further. I think I flipped through it the other day, but do you have something in here on heart math?
Oh, yes. It's okay. In that first or second chapter, I believe. I'm pulling my book up. I have it sitting.
Well,
right,
I don't need to know about the book. I want to know about, I want to hear you talk about heart math, because I find that stuff fascinating, because the Heart Math Institute is actually about 45 minutes drive from where I live. It's up there.
Wow.
I think it's in Boulder Creek, which is up above Santa Cruz in the mountains there. What was your introduction to heart math? And maybe we can talk a little bit about it for people who don't know much about it.
Yeah. I had, of course, I've been working with a lot of people that were doing therapy, and they kept mentioning heart math. And I'm like, what's that? During my schooling time, and I was still there. And I really didn't look into it a whole lot at that time. And then when I was done, and it really, I had it in the back of my mind, I'd looked it up and just kind of cursory look through it and all that. And it wasn't until I sat down and was reading my book and I was thinking about emotions, and I thought, oh, heart math, I need to go in more detail on that, because I believe that's the huge part of what's going on here as far as the connection that we have with our horses. So I looked into the heart math, and I realized, essentially, in a nutshell, it's about when we have different emotions, each emotion creates a wave of energy, and it's sent out into the field around us. So they can measure this energy field created by the heart outside of our bodies. And all the research they've done has shown that there's different emotions. If you have very negative emotions, it'll create this wave of energy that comes off of you that's very spiky and just irregular. And it actually eventually leads to you having health issues or having problems in, I don't know, staying relaxed and, you know, communicate. I'm having trouble. I'm looking up here and just saying, looking at all the different ways that it affects your body when you have a negative emotion, and it affects all your physiology. And so they're looking at all of that. And then on the flip side is they're looking at when you have a positive emotion, the wave that comes off of your heart and into the energy field that they can measure has a very smooth feel to it. It looks very smooth. And you've probably been around somebody that you immediately got in their presence and you could feel that love. And what they were doing was that heart wave that they were sending out was smooth and it felt good. And translating this to the horses, what I'll have people do is play with the different emotions. Let's go through some emotions and see how your horse reacts to that. And the horse can detect that electrical activity further away than the machines could. I think they can detect human heart energy from like 50 feet away. That's a long way. And I will have people play with different emotions and sending them out, and you'll watch the reaction from the horses, and you'll see very specific reactions that you cannot deny. You know, they'll say, oh, that was crazy. That horse just did this. And I'll say, well, okay, let's do it again. And let's see if we get the same reaction. So we'll do something else for a little bit. Now we're going to go recreate that emotion again, send it out. And I send it out through my breath and through my imagination. I just imagine that it's going out and sending in that direction. And whoop, the horse does the same exact thing again. Interesting. And one of the little exercises that I love to do with people is when they're in and they're saying, my horse won't connect with me. Look, he's off eating grass. And I say, well, let's do becoming the cookie. Let's figure out what emotion that horse really likes and that draws his attention to you. And so we'll play with it and I'll help them go through different emotions. And then we find the one the horse looks up. Huh, we got his attention. He stopped eating grass for a second. He looked over. Okay, now let's do more of that one and let's create that very strong in our mind and in our body and just breathe that emotion in our imagination. And 9 times out of 10, very quickly, the horse comes over and is right there. And we found the emotion that horse likes the most. And it's such a beautiful thing. And people get to see the reaction of the horse in real time, and they have the total control over that.
Well, now I feel like a Neanderthal.
Oh, no.
You know, I did a podcast with Leslie Desmond recently, and there was a story that I'd heard from a friend of mine who witnessed it at a private clinic in Sweden that Leslie was doing. And you know how legends are born, you know, like somebody does something and somebody sees it, and then but they see it differently than what actually happened, and then they repeat the story. The story is different than what happened, and then someone hears it and then they repeat it and it's different, and it ends up, you know, it's like Chinese whispers. And the story that I'd heard was that they were walking down a road between some pastures to go and get another horse or something for this clinic, and Leslie had been talking about getting a horse to do things without actually doing anything physically, like just through mental stuff. And there was the story I heard that there was 5 horses out in this pasture, like 4 sorrel horses and a bay horse, out eating grass, out in a pasture. And Leslie said to these people, here, I'll show you what I mean. I'm going to get the bay horse to come over here to the fence. And so there's 5 of them out there, and Leslie stands at the fence and looks out there. And after a few minutes, that bay horse lifts its head up and kind of looks around like, you know, it's got like a feeling or something, and it looks over towards the fence and walks over to him, and the other 4 don't even lift their heads up. And I had heard that, and I've always thought, that couldn't be possible. So the other day I asked Leslie, I hit her up and I said, okay, tell me, I want to know if this friend of mine, you know, if we're playing Chinese whispers and it happened completely differently than that. And I told her the story. She goes, nope. That's how it happened.
And that's where it's, you know, changing people's perceptions of what can be with your horses. And they think, oh, well, Leslie Desmond, of course she can do that, right? And that's the thing I want people to understand is like, yes, she can do that, and so can you. And it's here's these things, these invisible techniques that we do, and boy, you're going to be just amazed at what's happening with your horse. And it, for me, it would be like, of course she could do that, because that's the world I live in. Of course you can, you know, it's like, it doesn't seem abnormal, but I don't realize that there's so many people going, that's crazy. I don't believe that. What's going on? I don't get it. What, you know, so I think that's where, as we're bringing these different ideas and concepts in for people to play with for themselves, prove to yourself, you can do this. You can do this.
Yeah, you know, I think for me, and I don't know how many people out there are like me, but for me, I would have struggled to do this stuff 4 years ago because I wasn't in touch with me. You know what I mean? I was in my head, but I was not in my body. And so, you know, I've done quite a bit of somatic experiencing stuff since. And yeah, I'm a bit more in my body, and I can do this stuff a little bit that you're talking about. But I really think sometimes people are not, you know, I don't know what you think, but I think sometimes some of this stuff would be too far, not advanced, but people aren't in touch with themselves enough to be able to use their energy and emotions to get in touch with a horse. What do you think about that?
Absolutely. And I totally agree with you, because that's why I do these, go out and work with people one-on-one, because I can go in and I will ask people, okay, tell me what emotion you're having. And they say, I don't have one. I say, yes, you do. Let's look at this. And well, they'll tell me, well, I'm thinking this. It's like, no, I want your emotion. What are you feeling? And they'll keep going back to another thing. Well, I'm thinking that this, no, just sit here for a minute in the quiet space with your breathing, and we're going to find an emotion. Because you're right. So many people have shut down because of our society, because of what we do, and we're always on the fast lane, and emotions aren't for something we're supposed to pay attention to.
Right.
You know, those are in the way. Those are troublesome. We don't need any of those. But we can only control ourselves when we know who we are, and we know the emotions that we're creating, and we know how to either go with them, get information from them, or in this case, start to use them in our horsemanship. And so, yes, a lot of what I feel like I'm teaching is the very basics of, okay, what's an emotion?
Yeah, because like that? For me, I you know, like I said, I didn't have any, and it's funny when I first started seeing different therapists, they go, so how does that make you feel? I'm like, it doesn't. And then I got to where I did start feeling some stuff, and for me, you know, I really, you know, you just said, yes, you are, you have an emotion, you got to find out what it is. I really believe I wasn't having emotions.
Mm-hmm.
Because once I started having them, I was like, whoa, there's an alien in my body, you know. well, I haven't felt that. What the hell is that? So it wasn't like they were there and I wasn't. I just wasn't listening to it. I really don't think there was, for quite a long part, you know, a huge part of my life, I don't think there was anything. There was some, but they were very limited. You know, for me, it was like heartbreak, being in love, fear and dread. That was basically the range I had.
Uh-huh.
And so, and if you think about it, the only positive one of those was the being in love one, which is why I've always been a bit of a romantic sort of a thing, because that's the one way I could get that feeling. You know what I mean? Other things didn't give me that feeling. So, but yeah, I really didn't experience things at all. And when I started having emotions, holy cow, like watching TV was like watching it in 3D. Like if you're watching a drama and something happens, it's like in, what was it? Was it Aldous Huxley's Brave New World, where they go to the feelies? You know, they go to the movies, but they get plugged in and you feel you know, you get sensations of what's going on the screen. It was like that. And it was, holy cow, wow. I'd be sitting on the couch with Rob and I'm like, whoa, this is crazy.
And you're totally true. It's like how many people you come across, how many people I run into. It's like that's not part of their internal vocabulary. They don't even know what to look for. Don't even know it exists. And, you know, and I've worked with a woman recently, and we were in the round pen and we're trying to connect with a horse. And I said, okay, what about the emotion? She goes, I don't have any because I just push them down. And so I can't create any. I said, okay, so what we're going to do is we're just going to breathe here. And I love the concept of entrainment, which is that the energy waves start to copy each other. If you can hold a strong energy wave, you'll cause all the other waves in that field surrounding you to copy that and become that. And so I said, okay, what I'm going to do is put that in my body. And then you're going to just sit here for a little bit or stand here, whatever she was doing. And you're going to let me know when you start to sense something is different. Just sense. And she's like, oh, okay. Wow, that's weird. Just like you said, wow, that's weird. That's alien. And I think, you know, so much of the work that I do, you know, it started in the horse world, training horses, doing that. But I realized that was not where it needed to keep going. It needed some emphasis on the human part. How are horses going to help us become better humans?
I think that's a great line right there, because I think horses do help us become better humans. And I've said it before with different guests on the podcast that I've had a lot of feedback from people, you know, like an email or a private message or whatever, saying that, oh yeah, since I've been doing your stuff with the horses, it's really changed my life, and I'm really different with my husband or with my kids or with my coworkers or whatever. And they said, I would never have made those changes for my husband or my kids or my coworkers. But, you know, it seems like people will, when they're passionate about their horses, they will do whatever it takes to get along with them. And sometimes that's, you know, that's personal changes. And like I said, people have said, I would never have done that much work on myself or my husband or my kids or my job or whatever, but I did it for the horse. And I think that's something that that's very special about them is it's almost like they provide the impetus to do that, you know?
And I think that's so beautiful. And that's why I wanted to write the book, not from the place of here's another technique to use for your horse, but from the place of how can we make our horses' lives better? And I think that's the motivation for people to make a change. Like you said, it's for my horse. Well, of course, I will do anything to make my horse's life better. And in the process, unbeknownst to them, they make their own lives better.
Yeah, and a lot of times I think by the time they get to that point, they've exhausted every other thing.
Mm-hmm.
You know what I mean? Because the whole horse community, it's not set up to where when you're having a problem with your horse, you look inwards first. It's like, well, we'll sell you something to fix the problem, you know.
Yeah.
Whether it's a piece of equipment or a supplement or, you know, whatever.
Right. And you're right. All those things make people just look more externally for the answer rather than internally.
Yeah. And I totally there's no judgment behind that. I totally understand. That's how our society works. And that's how, you know, a lot of us are, you know, that's part of our culture. But I think it's good. People get to the place where they almost want to give up and they go, well, I'll try this crazy wackadoodle stuff over here. And,
exactly.
and then you get in the rabbit hole because then, you cannot, I really think you can't make those changes only for your horse.
Mm-mm.
Because once you make those changes, it affects every interaction you have with everyone and everything in your life.
Yes, it's absolutely true. And it's interesting that when I wrote the book, I sent a copy to my father, and he's written all sorts of books on parenting and child psychology and all those kind of things and relationship.
I thought you said he was a musician.
He was, but then he's like me. Of course he was, but then he did this other thing. And then he went and he started a company and he did all this child psychology and parenting. And he read my book and he says, "Wait, Susie, this isn't a book about horses, is it? It's a book about people." And I said, "Oh, you got that one right away. Okay, that's true. It's for both." But yeah, he realized that the scope of it is beyond just horses. It's hopefully encompasses more. And I think it's just the introduction to start thinking about these things. It's not the how-to you can do get everything fixed book. It's an introduction. And now you go on your own seeking journey and find these things out for yourself and find people to help you with these things. And you know, just watch what happens.
Yes. Yeah, it's pretty amazing stuff. You know what I might do now, if you don't mind? I might start asking you some of the questions that you had told me you wouldn't mind answering.
Oh, well, certainly.
Certainly. So the first one you picked out is, what's the luckiest thing that's ever happened to you?
Okay, I talked about that at the very beginning of this call. The day that you contacted me and the whole book got in your hands, I am putting that with a big star of the luckiest day of my life. Okay. So there you go. It's all your fault.
I think that's funny right there. Very, very funny. Oh my goodness. Now this next question, I'm pretty sure I know what it is, but I really want to know your take on it. What do you feel is your true purpose in the world?
I believe my true purpose in the world is to be a seed and put a seed of a different way of thinking into people's psyche, into their soul, into their mind, and just start them on their own journey of exploration. And I think just because of my age, I kept thinking, I'm running out of time. I've done nothing. I need to do something. And what is my purpose? And I think, well, just doing that, just the book was a big part of what is my purpose. I need to write this down. I need to get people thinking about this in a bigger way. And that's kind of what I want to leave this world going. I didn't just achieve things for myself. Maybe I made life better or different for even just one person or one person and their horse.
Yeah, you can't see me right now, but I'm giving you a big fist bump right there. Like that's the stuff. That's the stuff right there. Yeah, I kind of feel the same way. Okay, what's the most worthwhile thing that you've ever put your time into? This is going to be the book again, isn't it? What is the most worthwhile thing you've put your time into? Something that you've done that changed the course of your life?
And I believe this has been a theme throughout my life. The one, and I would call it a skill set, the ability to make mental images, very clear mental images, has been the thing that has changed my life for the better. I don't realize how often I do it until I really think about it. Every time I go to do something, I actually go through that thing in my mind beforehand, and then I see it transpire in much a similar way. And if I were to encourage anybody, if you were to pick one thing to do, it would be learn how to do that. Go back to being a kid and use your imagination and figure out how to think of something before you do it. And that way you see what might go wrong or what might go right, and you can play out all different scenarios. And it's beautiful. I did it when I was a musician. I would just play the song once. I would go through it in my mind, imagine myself playing it again and again. And, I didn't really have to practice because I practiced in my mind. So I think that's the thing that changed the course of my life more than anything else.
You know, have you ever heard of Dr. Joe Dispenza?
Yes.
You know, in some of his books, they talk about where they got people to, you know, practice lifting weights, and then they had another group of people mentally practiced lifting weights, and they had a, you know, had a third set of people who didn't do anything, and just the people who just mentally practiced lifting weights, mentally went through that, picturing it and the whole thing, you know, they had almost as much of a change as the people who were actually lifting weights.
Yes. And that is one of the things, that whole concept of Dr. Dispenza, and he has horses too, which I think is really fascinating.
Does he really? I didn't know that.
Yes. I think he used to talk a lot about his stallion that he would ride and doing different things, but it's how we take that skill and put it into our riding, and then just watching that one thing change a whole bunch of stuff with your riding and your horse's relationship with you. I think if somebody said you only have one skill you could keep, I'm just like, well, I'll keep that one and I'll keep developing that one.
So this is a question I ask people that I think can do it. So can you get your horse to do things by mentally picturing what you want him to do?
Yes.
Okay, my next question, this is the one I really want to know, is because I asked Leslie Desmond this one the other day, what perspective do you picture it from? From your perspective? From the horse's perspective? From like a bird's eye view perspective looking down? What is the mental picture?
Okay, so let me put myself in that situation.
So you don't even know what you do, do you? You gotta.
Yeah,
hang on,
I do different depending on this. See, this is one of those "it depends" questions.
Okay.
And so let's say a lot of times I'll do this demonstration with people and their horse, and I'll stand by the horse and I'll say, okay, in just a second, I'm going to ask him to move his front foot back a step. And before I even get the words out, he's already done it. And so I'm also picturing to him that his foot has gone back. I'm sending that picture to him in his mind. So I'm in my place. But here's the important part. I send that picture through an intention of love or fun or joy or something. It's the carrier emotion that is the important part of getting that to work consistently. And I think that's what people leave out. And I've found that, wow, if I go, wouldn't it be fun if you moved your back foot back there? And so I can feel that, like, kind of joy or wonder or something coming up in me. And then the horse, like, I'm just thinking that and he's doing it already. It's like, wow, he is quick. And horses I don't know. Horses I've never seen before. And so that's what's interesting. Yes, you can do it. It takes some mental practice. So don't go out there and think, oh, I'm going to do it and I didn't get it done and now I'm a failure. No. This is about knowing you didn't put in there an idea that it wasn't going to work, or Dr. Faye's silly and she's insane, and there was no other thought in there other than, oh boy, wouldn't it be fun if you moved your foot back? Oh, thanks for doing that. You know, and so it's, the intention is important, but the way you say it is important in your energy.
You know, I don't know what the hell happened right then, but in the middle of that, I got this feeling. Oh, this is so weird because I'm only new to having feelings. I got this sensation in my chest right then that was very, very strong, like a very strong somatic sensation. And I don't even know what that was.
Wow. So maybe it resonated somewhere within your body that was.
Yeah, holy cow. Oh, I got some weird stuff going
on.
Wow. Yeah, and I'm sure there are people listening who were thinking right then, I could never do that. But for anybody who's listening who thinks you can't do that, just picture a time when you were hosing your horse off and you were thinking, please don't step on the hose. How many times have you been hosing your horse and the water stops, you look down and your horse has got his back foot on the hose? And that's probably what you were thinking the whole time was, don't step on the hose, don't step on the hose, don't step on the hose. And you can't think anything that says don't. All you know, you can't not picture a pink elephant.
Mm-hmm.
Very cool.
Exactly.
Okay, I'm gonna ask you another question while I'm sitting here with my chest pain.
Uh-oh, I'm so sorry.
That's all right. That's all right. It's not chest pain, but it's a strong sensation that's still there. So.
Oh, good.
Okay, I love this question. I love people's answers to this one because it really, if someone hasn't figured out yet that failure is a good thing, I love people answering this question. This question is, what is your biggest failure and how has it helped you?
Okay. See, and that one is where I have to go back and make the pictures of the time that this happened, and it's painful. And I don't like to go back, but I think it's important to go. Every time we have a failure, it's just information. It's information on, okay, next time I'll do it different. That didn't work. I need to find a different way. And so this is kind of a little bit of a story, and I'll make it as short as I can here. I had a chance when I was in Western Colorado on the ranch, and I had some young horses, and someone was coming into town to do a colt starting clinic. And I'm so excited. I've got the perfect candidate. He's just ready. I'm ready. I'm going to go to this thing. And in a nutshell, we were on, everything was going well. And then this person flagged me and my horse into the roping chute, face forward. We had nowhere to go. And then they stood behind me with the flag and continued to flag until the horse just had no options. Like, what is going on? I have no option but just blow up. And so, of course, I come off face plant in front of the entire town, right? And it's humiliating. And being me, I get back on. He does it two more times, same exact scenario. And then tells me, you have no business starting horses. You're not big enough. You're not strong enough. You're not like me. And it was the turning point in my life, the failure of, like, I thought I was a decent horse person. And look, I just got bucked off three times at the same clinic within a few minutes. And really, I should just hang it up. I need to quit thinking this. I need to quit my dream. I need to quit all of this. I have no business. And I sat on that for several days, and it's funny, again, how the universe or God comes in and says, oh, wait, my husband comes home that day from work and goes, oh, my secretary there, the receptionist, says that her daughter teaches natural horsemanship. She's up in Montana. So she's going to do a clinic in about a week, and said, you know, encourage you to go. And it took everything I had to go to that clinic because I was so humiliated. I was so devastated. And it was the best thing that ever happened. It set me on a different course entirely. A different way of looking at natural horsemanship from a woman's perspective, and a woman who was my size, who was small, who was not, you know, the big burly guy that has all the strength and power and force that I would never have. And so there we go. The biggest failure was the thing that propelled me to where I'm at now. And I'm so thankful for that.
Sounds like quite the failure.
Yeah.
Wow. Yeah. Instances like that, you learn a lot. You either learn the way you want to do things or learn the way you don't want to do things.
Mm-hmm.
Okay. Mm-hmm. Next question. Where do you find motivation or inspiration for what you do?
I find the motivation is in the horse itself. For me to go, wait, I've got information that can make horses' lives better. Yep. And then when I go and work with a client and their horse, I'm inspired because usually what happens is something I couldn't even have imagined. And so they provide me with that ongoing inspiration that, yes, keep doing this, because I always think, well, if somebody doesn't cry after the session, then I didn't do a good job. And cry in a good way, not the way I cried at that clinic that I got bucked off on, but cry because things were different and things from now on were going to be different.
Okay, I think that's great. And the last question that you selected was, what do you think it means to be a leader and a follower? What does leadership, followership look like to you?
Okay. For me, and this comes up a lot of times for me in different clinics that I do, and people have gotten an idea that leadership equals being the boss and making sure your horse does what it wants, what you asked it, in a timely fashion, and otherwise it should get reprimanded. And for me, I have a completely different idea. I don't go into leadership with, I'm going to change my body language and assume the position of stiffness in the leader and the authority and all that that comes with what I think maybe a leader is. And I try to model it after a horse that I had that I believed was the true leader of the herd. And she was the one that everybody went to. They liked to be around her, but they didn't mess around. They knew that if they did something, she was a bird mare, so she would be in charge of all the foals. You know, the mare, the other mares would leave their foals with her, and they would go off and graze, and she would watch over everyone. And I thought, oh, they really trust her. They trust her with their own babies. And so, but she's not mean or nasty. She doesn't try to bite them. If they tried to do something, you know, like colts will do, is kick at the mare or do try to bite them and come up. And all she would have to do is give them a look and just very gently just flick an ear, and it was, they would just stop. And so it was this compassion, this empathy she had, and this ability to just stand in her truth of who she was. And I think everybody followed her. Everybody followed her. Everybody wanted to be around her. But they didn't try anything nasty to her. They never even thought about it, I don't think. And so leadership for me is just being in that place of, am I consistent? Am I consistent in my emotional and mental state? And am I trustworthy? Does a horse know what to expect from me? And does a horse look to me for support and guidance? And those are what I believe for me is the leadership. And it's worked for me within the horse world. And I haven't had to be strong and forceful and all those kind of things to achieve that level of leadership with a horse.
Yeah, great stuff. Wow. I think that's very good. You know what I am going to do here? I am going to read to you guys the very last thing in the book Sacred Spaces by Dr. Susan Fay. So you ready? You guys ready for this? You ready for this? You've heard this before because you wrote it. It says, this book was written from my heart. In my heart is a love for horses. I can't recall a time that horses have not been a part of my being, my essence. In my heart, I feel that's important for people to hear or to read about the concepts contained in this, in the pages of this book, not for my sake, but for the sake of the horse. I often hear horse owners or trainers tell stories of their once-in-a-lifetime horse. Now you know that every horse has the potential to be a once-in-a-lifetime horse. What we should strive is to be our horse's once-in-a-lifetime human. Horses gift us with their power, beauty, grace, and wisdom. Becoming better humans can be a gift to them. I think that might be a great way to wrap up our podcast here. What do you think of that, Dr. Susan?
I believe so, and I believe those are from my heart. Those words are from my heart and how I truly do believe.
So apart from where can people, well, let's ask this, where can people buy the book Sacred Spaces?
Sacred Spaces right now is on Amazon, okay, and either a hard copy, the paperback, or on digital. I like the paperback just because I'm a person that likes pictures. So in the paperback has pictures. So just go to Amazon and you can find it there. And if you're overseas, I think some people that have that available too.
Perfect. And do you, what about any other way people can learn more about you, contact you, things like that? Do you have a website?
I have a website, drsusanfay.com. And I haven't been on there for, I haven't really updated that a lot. So that's probably the least way to get in touch with me. And Facebook is the easiest way. And that's just Susan Fay. Or I have three different sites. One is Dr. Susan Fay, and one is my personal page of just Susan Fay, and there's of course horses there, so you'll know it's the right one. And then I have another Facebook page called Science and Spirit of Horses.
Ooh, I got to write that down. I need to be on that one. Science and Spirit of Horses.
I'll be ramping up more on those sites here shortly, because I started just a couple of them a little while ago and I haven't posted a whole lot on those. But I have a feeling that maybe things might change here.
I get that feeling too. So Dr. Susan Fay, thank you so much for joining me on the podcast. It's been an absolute pleasure talking to you and listening to what you have to say. And during some of your monologues there, I was just kind of listening but flipping through this book further ahead, because I haven't really looked further ahead, and I'm like, oh my God, this book is so good. I can't wait to get further ahead in it. So once again, thank you so much for joining me, and thank you for writing this book and putting this out there, because I think this is something that everybody needs to be aware of.
Absolutely. And thank you for being brave and talking about these different things that aren't mainstream yet, because they're going to become mainstream pretty soon.
I think they're getting a lot more mainstream than you think. So,
yeah.
And I think this book will go a long way to making that more so. So once again, thank you so much for joining me, and all your listeners, thanks for joining us on the Journey On podcast. We'll catch you in the next episode.
Thanks for listening to the Journey On podcast with Warwick Schiller. Warwick has over 650 full-length training videos on his online video library at videos.warwickschiller.com. Be sure to follow Warwick on YouTube, Facebook, and Instagram to see his latest training advice and insights.